If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial-free online anytime, webcast, at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Right now, we're going to go to the phones and want to introduce you to Dr. Justin Hart. He is a postdoctoral fellow with the Learning Agents Research Group in the Computer Science Department at the University of Texas at Austin. And he's a pretty fascinating guy. He's going to be speaking, making a presentation at MetroCon, the IEEE conference going on the 7th of November in Hearst, at the Hearst Convention Center. You can learn more about that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you will see a link. Welcome to the program, Dr. Hart.
Thank you.
Your research includes work in artificial intelligence, computer vision, and human-robot interaction. That sounds pretty fascinating to me. Can you help us delve into that a little further and tell us something about what you're up to?
Yeah, well, I work on quite a few things, actually. At UT Austin, I run a couple of really interesting programs. I'm the lead of our team for what's called RoboCup at Home.
Mm-hmm.
RoboCup at Home is a competition basically to build what are called domestic service robots. So these would be robots that you would buy in your home that would help you to do things like cook and clean and pick up after you and all the things that are necessary for, you know, housekeeping. I work on another project that's related called the Building-Wide Intelligence. And if you pictured robots that are ambient and present in an office environment that are doing things for people at work, that is the idea of the building-wide intelligence, is that these are robots that we actually use in the computer science department at UT Austin in practice. And as part of all that, I work on some problems related to artificial intelligence and human-robot interaction. I work on what's called semantic mapping. And the idea is that we have robots which drive around our department. And normally robots, when they want to navigate, they run a piece of software called simultaneous localization and mapping.
Mm-hmm.
And what this does is it builds a map of the floor of the building while simultaneously, hence the term simultaneous, localizing the robot. But what it doesn't do is it doesn't tell you what every room is or what the contents of those rooms are. What it tells you is the geometry of the building. What we're adding is what the contents are. So if you tell the robot, go find me a coffee, the robot will remember where the coffee mess is. Or bring me to Justin Hart's office, it will have made a note where my office is and take you there. So that's one aspect of what I've been working on. Another aspect of what I've done in the past is my doctoral thesis was all about the study of robots which learn about themselves through experience. We took the test which is used to study self-awareness in animals, which is called the mirror test, and we tried to accomplish that on a robot. Now, we didn't get all the way to passing the mirror test, but we did pass a test which is sort of a precursor to the mirror test, where the robot has to do spatial reasoning by looking into a mirror. And so that's sort of an overview of some of the stuff. The human-robot interaction stuff I've been doing lots of interesting things with. We've been working on robots navigating shared spaces and not running into people and clearly indicating where they're going. We've been working on things like how do people understand different types of gestures and how do they maybe learn how those gestures work. I've been looking at some things that have to do with eye gaze, so how do you understand what a person is looking at, how can a robot understand that, and how can a robot generate a gaze cue which you understand, which is to say that you understand what the robot's looking at. So that's just a handful of the things that I've been working on. There's been a lot of really good stuff going on.
Yeah, it sounds really exciting. Did you say one of the things you're doing is teaching the robot to look into the mirror? Is that right?
Well, that's some older work that I did, and we are kind of getting started back up on that. We haven't done anything super, super recently on that, but we're kind of getting started back up on that. I gave a talk in September that was a retrospective on my doctoral dissertation work where we did that, And what we're working on is potentially enhancing that in the coming year. But that's sort of upcoming work.
Is that so the robot could recognize himself or herself or itself, that sort of thing?
That is the idea, yep.
Okay, and then that would lead, of course, to the burning question. These robots, they look like us, or do they look like machines? What do they look like?
Well, we have a variety of different robots. So the robot that I work the most with is probably the BWI bot. So that's the robot that we developed for the building-wide intelligence project. And that's on a two-wheeled mobile self-balancing base. And then what we do is we stack computers on top of that, and we have a robot arm and then a suite of sensors. So that is a robot that is about as tall as I am. And I'm 5'9", and it has one arm, and it doesn't look much like a person at all. There's another robot that we work with, which is called the Toyota Human Support Robot. That's what we use for RoboCup at home. Mm-hmm. And that robot is designed to look a little bit more like a person. It's shorter. It's designed to look very cute. It still has sort of standard robot sensors scattered throughout its head, and a single arm, and it is an omnidirectional base, so it can go at any moment in any direction it wants to, or it's pretty close to omnidirectional. And it's short and looks a little bit more like a person, but these don't tend to look a whole lot like a person, partly because it's just not the focus of the research. You know, we have a capability that we want the robot to be able to carry out, and there's a whole area of research which is just making robots that look just like people. That would be Android research. And since we're not in that area, we don't want to do, you know, bad work in that area. We want to have a robot that's functional and has all the pieces that we want and allows us to study what we want, without adding on the complexity of an area that we're really not working in.
Right. Yeah, we worked with a group here in Dallas a number of years ago, about 10 years ago, I think, that was creating robots that had facial features that would do expressions and things like that, looked like humans. And the big complaint was is that nobody wanted a machine that looked like a human being. They wanted a machine that looked like a machine. So is that the reason that you're avoiding this?
Well, so you're probably talking about Hanson Robotics.
Yeah. Are they still in business?
Yeah, Hanson's still doing great stuff. I don't know that people don't want it, but you know, when you run a research group, you have to pick and choose your problems. Mm-hmm. And we focus on the artificial intelligence and the machine learning and aspects of the human-robot interaction. Certainly, as you have a machine that looks more like a person, the human-robot interaction changes, but you can only accomplish so much with one group. And so what we do is we focus our efforts and where we want to be able to make our contributions. And the places that we want to be able to make the contributions have more to do with the artificial intelligence than the appearance of the robot, so that's what we focus on.
Well, it appears.
I wouldn't say that we explicitly avoid having human-looking robots. I would say that it's just that's not where we've built our expertise.
Well, it seems like you're really working to make these machines very lifelike. I mean, learning where your office is, learning where the coffee is, learning all these things, development of domestic service robots, which could perform cooking and other maybe clean our bathroom for us and everything else. So these are really useful robots. We've had industrial robots, of course, for years, and they look like industry, you know, perform the same task over and over and over. But this, you're working on robots that will be very versatile. That's what I'm seeing, right?
Yeah, versatility is certainly an aspect of what we do. We've been working on what's called an architecture for long-term autonomy. Mm-hmm. When you think about an industrial robot, when you think about a robot that works on a factory line, usually those robots are programmed to do one very specific task, which is what you're driving at with this versatility thing. that specific task may be so specific as picking up an item and putting it from one conveyor belt to another conveyor belt, right?
Mm-hmm.
The robot doesn't have to do any reasoning to do that because it always follows the same path with its motion. So there is usually just a piece of control code that simply does that pickup from one place to the other. There may be some sensing to say this is where the item was, is on the assembly line. When you move into offices and homes, what you're really lacking is the structure that defines those tasks. You know, when people cook, they don't cook on a conveyor belt. They don't cook the same thing every day. When you clean, by definition, the items aren't where they're supposed to be, right? If you're picking up, you know, children's toys off the floor or putting away components in a laboratory, the reason that you're putting them away is because they're not where they're supposed to be. So an industrial robot would be easily tripped up by those scenarios. Part of what makes it so hard to translate a technology directly from a factory to the home is the unstructured nature of the home. And that is sort of what we try to cope with. We've been working on this big architecture for our robots. So an architecture being like, I want a part of the robot that does a pre-scripted thing. Like, it knows that its job right now is to pick up all the toys, and so it's going to look for toy and next toy and the next toy. But it may need to do some reasoning. It may need to say, hey, the door to the toy chest is closed right now, and so I need to open that up in order to put toys into it. So we have another aspect that allows the robot to do planning and reasoning. And then maybe we have a really good motion planner, or maybe we have a really good piece of software that does sensing, and we want to be able to plug that into our system. So the architecture dictates how all those pieces fit together. So we've been working on an architecture which allows us to deploy different experimental pieces of software in our piece of software that drives the robot by default throughout the day. So this allows us to sort of bridge that gap between the short-term experimental things and the long-term autonomy of just maintaining a fleet of robots that works in our building.
Okay, so these robots now, are they going to be connected to GPS or the internet? Is that how they're going to work?
There are parts that you would split apart. You could connect them to GPS, but since they're indoors, usually we don't use GPS. What we would use is laser scans of the building or visual scans that allow us to look at where we are and the reason about our position based on sensor data. And the reason that we do that is partly because GPS isn't reliable down to, like, you know, a couple centimeters, which is how well we want to position the robot, and partly because it's not reliable inside a building. You know, you have all sorts of concrete floors and steel beams and things like that that mess up the GPS signal. It's true that you can have indoor GPS technologies, but actually we're able to localize the robot much more accurately by building maps of the interior space and using laser scanners to determine where the robot is inside that space.
So we're not going to get some insidious Russian or Chinese hacker hacking in and turning the robot into a monster that goes ahead and messes up the whole house or starts attacking people or pets. Is that right?
Well, there is a whole area of computer security that deals with breaking into any kind of computer. There is also an area of computer security that's more specific to robotics. That's really just beginning to be explored because people are really just beginning to deploy these systems. There is a legitimate concern that if you had, for instance, a fielded robot, like a telepresence device, that someone could use that robot to explore parts of the building that they're not supposed to. And, you know, right now the solution is basically lock the door to the room that the robot's in. But as people want these robots to be able to autonomously wander through their buildings, of course security will be a concern. We don't really have great solutions to that yet. The way that we secure the robots right now is the way that we secure all the rest of our computers. And, you know, so far that's worked really well for us.
Yeah, well, you when we were planning this, you said you thought it'd be kind of tricky to bring a robot to the conference. Although I think that would be sensational if you manage that. But you thought you might have some brand new stuff on semantically mapping buildings, and I guess that's what we're talking about right now. You map out the building, you feed that to the computer or to the robot, and the memory takes over, and then pretty soon you've got a trained robot to do whatever he wants to do in the building, or whatever you want him to do in the building.
Yeah, that's accurate. Yeah, we've been doing quite a lot with semantic mapping over the past few months, and our plan going into this year is to do more semantic mapping stuff. We just submitted a publication to IROS, IEEE IROS, which is the International Conference on Robots and Intelligent Systems.
Mm-hmm.
So the deal with that paper is that we have the robot that wanders around the building a map. Right now we have a human driver, but we're getting rid of the human driver. And what it does is it looks for all the building signs, it reads the sign, and then it takes that sign and annotates it into the map. So, you know, if you look for my office number and the office that has my name on it, when the robot marks its location in the map, it can also look at the sign and say, okay, I saw the sign in this position, it marks that position down the map, and now it knows where my office is, because it's being able to read the building signs. But you could also picture looking around for different landmarks, like if it wants to know where, you know, our kitchenette is, it can look for the fridge and it can look for the coffee pot and things like that. And so we're adding in all those types of capabilities so that if you said, you know, go get me a coffee, it remembers where the coffee pot is, or it remembers where the cafeteria is downstairs, to be able to get us those things. And we're teaching it different types of semantics, like things like operating the elevator. We have three robots that have some type of robot arm on there, and really only one that we've tried driving the elevator with by pushing the buttons with its arm. But you could picture reading all the floors and saying, I want to go to the fifth floor, and then it pushes the button on the elevator. And so, ideally, the robot will automatically extract this information for itself. And we're working towards different technologies that would allow us to do that. Right now, when we do that, we sort of have this a bunch of different approaches that we've come up with localizing an object because we're looking for an object, or marking out where someone's office is on the floor. The part that we've automated now is reading the signs to determine where someone's office is on the floor. But what we want to do is develop a good memory of where all the objects are or what objects might move. You know, if someone puts down a Coke can on their desk, that Coke can probably won't be there a few hours from now. So these are the sorts of problems that we're looking at.
Well, it sounds like industry is going to be your first customers if these things, when these things make it to market. But I could imagine that the average person is going to be really interested in that domestic service robot, which will, do the cooking and clean the bathroom and that sort of thing. And those are going to have to be priced so that people can afford it. Look down the road a little bit there into the future, 5, 10, 15, you know, or more years. How do you see the development of these systems?
Well, that's a big question. You know, right now, when you look at the efforts from industry, they do attack this on multiple fronts. One is just being able to do this at all. Like, there is a very large gap between what we're able to accurately model in artificial intelligence to build build systems which can learn and reason about, and what we'd like to be able to model. So right now, when I look at those problems, I look at if I take everything I can get, if I take the best computers and the best robot hardware, what can I do to solve this problem in my laboratory? And then what's the difference between my laboratory and the real world, right? So, you know, it's still very difficult to reliably identify an object, pick it up, put it down, memorize where it was. You know, it seems like that would be very basic, but that's actually quite tricky. It's very tricky to know where all the people are in the room or which operator was talking to you. It's very tricky to follow a person through a crowded space, right? All that stuff is tricky just with our modern technology. So what I really focus on is if I have all the resources in the world available to me and the brightest minds working on this, what can I do to make this robot work? There is another angle, which is how do we make this affordable?
Yeah.
You know, The commercialization aspect of that and turning it into an affordable thing is something that a bunch of the various industry partners that I've worked with have approached. That's challenging on its own front. There will eventually be an economy of scale thing happening, but if you look at the cost of production of like a good robot arm right now, part of it is that there just aren't that many robot arms out there. So part of that will, part of that will go away as more are produced. But part of it's actually just that we don't have really easy ways to machine these things cheaply. We don't have components that we can accomplish the types of grasping, manipulation, things that we want to accomplish inexpensively yet. I assume that will come with time. That as we iterate and as we build more of these things, that will happen. But to give an example of an economies of scale thing, if you look at 3D point cloud cameras, so these are cameras that take a three-dimensional picture. Instead of having regular pixels in a two-dimensional plane, it has what are called point cloud points, or a point cloud, which is, it's like an image, but with each color in the image is also associated a 3D coordinate, right? If you take those and you look at the cost of that technology, it was, when I started grad school, maybe $5,000 per camera. And then Microsoft made the Kinect and sold it as a video game peripheral, and it was mass manufactured, and you could get those cameras for $200 a piece, like a year after they were $5,000 a pop.
Yeah.
And now that there aren't really very many large manufacturers that are producing those cameras, they've become more expensive, but the technology's gotten much better, and their availability has become bigger. So I think that what will really happen is that a lot of these things that right now are just strikingly expensive will tumble in costs as mass production sort of takes over. It costs maybe $100,000 to build one thing, but then the second that you start building 100 of them, they become much cheaper because you're not just building one thing anymore. You don't have to ramp up, a specialist machinist to build that thing. You can put it onto an assembly line and make hundreds of them and thousands of them.
Right. Well, that's why the standard housewife or house husband is going to look forward to a domestic robot sometime down the road when things get cheap. We're going to really look forward to your talk at the Metricon conference. That's going to be November 7th. Remind people, November 7th at the Hearst Convention Center. More information on that at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you will see a link to the website for the IEEE Metricon conference. We look forward to seeing you there, Dr. Hart. And before we go, I know that you've been mentored by some really fantastic people. You've been working with Peter Stone and some others, and I know that they've mentored you, and you're mentoring others. And I wonder if maybe you could give us some words to live by, or something that in your profession or in your you could come up with maybe a creed to live by, or a guide to life. You have something for us?
Oh, I don't know if I have anything like that. I know that I always have been inspired by the people who I've worked with who've had a great idea and a passion that they pursue, something that they really are chasing, and that they're involved in this business in research because it's the questions that drive them. That's really, if you're going to go into science and research, that's what you want, is you just want to be driven by your intrinsic interest in what you're researching. However, I will also say that, becoming successful in terms of research is really, it's a challenging game. There are a lot of different facets to it. All you can really do is find a problem that interests you and work very hard on it.
All right. Well, Dr. Justin Hart, postdoctoral fellow with the Learning Agents Research Group in the Computer Science Department at the University of Texas at Austin, going to be making a presentation at the IEEE Metricon Conference on November 7th at the Hearst Convention Center. We'll look forward to seeing you there, and I want to thank you very much for being a guest on our program today.
Well, thank you.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Science News Radio Network special presentation, Promise of Tomorrow, with Colonel Mason. Those of you listening on radio can also hear us commercial commercial-free online anytime webcast at promiseoftomorrow.biz.